This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Why are the media telling you fairy tales about the real death toll in the Bahamian disaster called Dorian? And why aren't they telling you about massive fires in Russian Siberia this summer? We will talk about the deadly storm with Canadian scientist Paul Beckwith for about 15 minutes. Then we go to Mark Parrington, a senior scientist at the European Center for Medium-Range Weather Forecasts. Mark works on the Copernicus Project, Europe's Eyes on Earth. The Copernicus Atmospheric Monitoring Service tracked over 100 big wildfires in the Arctic Circle just since June. Then Beckwith and I return to analyzing public insanity and the unthinkable risks of changing the climate. News snippets coming out of the Bahamas Islands after Hurricane Dorian are hiding an awful truth. The real death toll will be staggering. America is closing its doors to its next-door neighbors in need. And it's bigger than that. What islands in the Caribbean will have to be abandoned? It's about time to figure that out. Paul Beckwith teaches climate science at universities and on the net with more than 500 climate videos on YouTube. Paul is a regular contributor to Radio EcoShock. Paul Beckwith, thank you for dropping by on such short notice.
Thank you for having me, Alex.
I admit, I thought your video about the Bahamian death toll and your wild solution was too much, even for this show. But, you know, within 24 hours, the mainstream media was swinging right in your direction. And so let's start with the death toll, which was obviously lowballed from day one. What were they saying about the number of fatalities when you started making your video?
Well, first of all, I mean, people don't really understand the extent of the destruction. I mean, you've got basically 185 mile per hour sustained wind, 25 foot storm surge. You know, it sits over the island for 2 days, literally. And 185 miles an hour, I mean, that's sustained. There were gusts up to 225, and buildings just can't survive that. I mean, an EF4 tornado is, I think, about 166 to 200 miles an hour, roughly. EF5 greater than 200 miles an hour. So we're talking about EF4, EF5 tornadoes sitting on top of you, not for a minute like it happened with the tornadoes, but for a full day. So the destruction was enormous. And they were saying a death toll of five. You know, they said at least five people have died. And what they did is they had five bodies in body bags. And then the number went to 10 and 15 and 20. And I think the latest is 50. And these numbers are just completely absurd. Like, they make no sense whatsoever, and they mislead the public as to how bad the storm really is.
Aerial shots of Abaco Island found communities just a jumble of wreckage, and yet they were only finding a dozen bodies at first. What do you think happened to some of the people there?
Well, to come up with my number, I didn't just pull it out of a hat. I said, okay, look, what's the populations of these places? So Grand Bahama is just over 51,000. I couldn't even find up-to-date numbers. That's a 2010 number. If you go on Wikipedia for Grand Bahama, Wikipedia for Abaco Island. Okay, so 51,000, you know, and it's probably close. It's probably a bit higher because the population versus on its death is probably a bit higher. There's not much immigration. Anyway, so 51,000 plus on Grand Bahama and 17,000 plus on Abaco Island, but also there were a lot of undocumented Haitians, so estimated 7,000 to 9,000 on Abaco and 10,000 to 12,000 on Grand Bahama. So what I did is I thought, okay, well, I mean, two-thirds of the island was submerged. You look at the damage, not many people left. 20,000 hot meals were served of people, survivors going onto different islands, you know, roughly, but that included support workers as well, so a bit less. You know, how many people were going to the U.S., how many people were lining up to get off on ferries and stuff to be evacuated after the storm. You know, just the lack of people. I mean, those images were horrifying, flattened building. What can survive the conditions that were unleashed by Hurricane Dorian on these islands? So basically, I started coming up with estimates, trying to consider all of the factors, you know, top-down estimates. And you know, I came up with a number of something like 30, 35, 40,000. So I did the video. And since I did the video, actually some relief workers on the ground commented on my YouTube channel. And one of them that seemed most legitimate was saying that, you know, of the 17,000 people on Abaco Island, maybe 2,000 left, evacuated before the storm. After the storm, they took about 3,500 people off the island, so that's 5.5. So 17 minus 5.5 is about 11,500 people that were missing, presumed dead, from Abaco Island alone. Now, Grand Bahama, you know, lots of people are on Freeport Island. So of that 51,000, this, you know, this relief worker said he estimated maybe 20% of the population perished from Grand Bahama, which would be another 10,000. So his number was about 21,500 people. I said, well, those are all the people that are documented. What about the undocumented people? And he didn't think, you know, basically on Abaco Marsh Harbor, there were very, very few survivors. So you need to add about another, you know, 9,000 people, 7 to 9, call it 8, from Abaco, you know, undocumented Haitians. Add another, you know, on Grand Bahama, there's maybe 10 to 12,000 undocumented Haitians estimated. So, you know, lots in Freeport. So and they were on lower ground and didn't have the, they had shanty-type shelters and stuff. I mean, they weren't protected. They weren't in decent buildings. So, you know, so if even half of them perish, that would be about 5,000. So if you add all those numbers together, you know, 10 from Grand Bahama, 11 and a half from Abaco, and then 8 and 5 for the Haitians, that those numbers all add up to about 35-something. And this is I found out after the fact. I did the video, and then I got some information the next day, you know, and I added up the numbers and said, are my numbers told any truth to my numbers? Are they, I hope I'm terribly wrong, but, you know, that relief worker, if you add those numbers from him, it's about 35,000 or something. It's unbelievable how mainstream media reports on death tolls after a catastrophe. You know, they find 5 bodies, you know, and not the wreckage, and they say the death toll is 5 or greater. Right? You can always say 5 or greater, you know. Yeah, 40,000 is greater than 5 people, right? But, I mean, the numbers are completely absurd. And given the horrendous, you know, category, you know, EF4, EF5 equivalent tornado sitting over you for 2 days, not going, passing by in a minute or 2 minutes like it normally does. I mean, the gusts were up to 225 miles an hour. Like I said, the storm surge, 2/3 of the island was submerged. So death tolls are huge. And I don't understand why, you know, anybody can sort of, with common sense, can sort of reason through what I've done. It's not rocket science and say, you know, the numbers, that official numbers are just out to lunch completely. You know, many, many people would have deemed it as just washed out to sea. The storm surge coming in, being there for a long period of time, several days, and then washing out to sea. I mean, the people missing is probably at least half. So doing body counts on the ground, you know, isn't the reality of what happened. The only way they can know for sure is to do an accurate population census of the whole country, figure out how many people went to the U.S., et cetera, add those numbers, and then compare the number of people there to the number of people on the whole Bahamas before the previous population census, estimate the number of undocumented people, add them in and get a realistic number. But nobody wants a realistic number. But the problem is it hides the extent of the disaster, the catastrophe.
But why? You know, I mean, the Russians still claim only 30 people died from radiation at the Chernobyl nuclear accident in the 1980s. And the Japanese say only one person died from all that radiation release when 4 nuclear reactors blew up at Fukushima. I just don't get it. Why do governments have to hide the deaths? And wouldn't it be in the interests of the government of the Bahamas to say, yes, we think tens of thousands of people have passed here, and that's why we need your international aid. That's why we need international aid workers right now. But instead, it's like 5 people. Oh, well, we found 10 today. It's crazy.
I know. It's totally absurd. And the problem is, like, if Reuters comes and says 5 people or more, then that report is taken by other news agencies and goes around the world, CAN News, right? So, you know, you hear the same thing from multiple news agencies. You know, I mean, these catastrophes and people dying, you know, it's a very difficult topic. And governments are just extremely happy to hide that information, like to not let the true numbers come out. In the case of the Bahamas, 50% of their gross national product is from tourism. You know, when people hear the Bahamas got struck, they're really, you know, there's so many different islands on the Bahamas, and the two northernmost islands, Grand Bahamas and Abaco Island, those are ones that got destroyed completely by the hurricane. But there's lots of other Bahama islands, lots of other people. You know, if it was 30 to 40,000 people perished, that's over 10% of the total population of the Bahamas. And they want more and more tourists to go. They don't want tourism is going to take a big hit, of course, with these storms, but they're downplaying the number of casualties. I mean, they try to downplay the severity of the event, and it does the world no good at all, because, you know, we really have to talk about how these hurricanes, we're getting more, for every degree Celsius rise in temperature, there's 25 to 30% more Category 4 and 5 hurricanes versus Category 1 and 2. The storms are moving more slowly. These hurricanes are moving more slowly, and we had unprecedented stalling of the Category 5 Dorian right over the Bahamas. It was like it was pegged there. It like got stuck there. And the conditions, of course, with those winds for such a long period of time and the storm surge, I mean, nobody can survive that. Like, I'm amazed when I see the, you know, houses that look like they're relatively intact on those islands. I mean, they must have been submerged first before the 200-mile-an-hour, 185-mile-an-hour winds came. Otherwise, they wouldn't be there, right? So they were probably submerged, and then the winds were blowing, of course, above the water, and then when the storm surge went down, the walls are still intact and so on some of these houses. I think that's probably what may have happened.
And then I had such a problem accepting your number as anything realistic, you know, up to 40,000 dead in the Bahamas. And then I realized that we've become numb to high death numbers anyway. Up to 70,000 people died in that, the European heat wave of 2003, about 60,000 in the Russian heat wave 2010. The Boxing Day tsunami 2004 killed over 200,000 people in Asia. So as climate change gets even worse with these surreal events, I suppose we'll just accept numbers like tens of thousands dead, and as long as it doesn't happen in the United States or to anybody we know, well, life goes on, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, there's a very famous or infamous quote. I think it's attributed to Stalin. I mean, the death of one person is a tragedy. The death of a million people is a statistic. Like I said, I mean, we really need to have a census on the population. You know, we need to count the number of people and compare them to what was done before. But since governments aren't really that interested, I mean, there's lots of comments on the video, of course, over 300 comments. And some people are saying, well, Bahamas just cares about living, the people left, the living people, you know, and like people have to move on. And it's just too hard to think about those sort of numbers of people. But I guess the big question is, what do we do? I mean, are we just going to rebuild the Bahamas, those islands, and go on as if nothing has happened? I mean, remember, let's go back 2 years ago, almost exactly 2 years ago, to Hurricane Irma, which had a direct hit on Barbuda, you know, a very small island, right? It's part of Antigua and Barbuda is the country, and Barbuda is north of Antigua, and the eye of the hurricane just, it was also 185-mile-an-hour winds, but it was moving along. You know, it wasn't moving that fast, but it was moving, and it went through the island, destroyed 95% of the infrastructure. Now, there's caves on the island. You know, it's a higher elevation, so there were very, very few fatalities. They said one baby died, and that was it, of the 1,600 people on the island. So if you believe that number. But anyway, then they got everybody off the island. It was the first time the island had been uninhabited for 300-400 years, they figured. And immediately, military went on the island, people to rebuild a huge airport, and they started changing the entire nature of the island. And the people that were evacuated off had no say, really, in what was done. You know, some of the males were allowed back on in about 6 weeks, but most of the people were, you know, they had to stay off the island. They were evacuated for about 3 months. Meanwhile, military contractors, you know, this is disaster capitalism, perfect example of it. They plowed over the parts of the forest and stuff. Oh, but there's caves on the island, so they figured people just went into the caves. You know, it was part of the culture there that you'd often sleep in these massive caves. So I think the population during the storm, they just went into the caves. It wasn't affected by storm surge too high up. And, you know, most people survived. And then they came out after the winds died down. And they had forced evacuation. A lot of them didn't want to, just wanted to stay. You know, they didn't want to be evacuated, but they had no choice. So anyway, they were all moved off, and they were kept off the island for a long time. Meanwhile, the military and contractors and stuff, I mean, machinery went in, and they plowed down a vast part of the forest to put an airport, a brand new airport in. But there were caves, and that area was no good. So then they plowed a second area to try to put the new airport in, and the same thing, a third one. Finally, the fourth try, they got their new airport in. And there's, you know, people want to build big, huge hotels and stuff. I mean, basically, it's the culture that existed there, you know, is probably going to be lost. I mean, you know, when people were kept off the island for so long, their kids start going to schools and stuff. They were all in Antigua, and, you know, a lot of people haven't moved back. So the other thing is that there were pledges of huge amounts of money for rebuilding, like for millions and millions of dollars. I think Canada even put up $3 million. And it was a total of about $10 million pledged, and they haven't received not a cent of the money that was pledged 2 years ago has actually gone to the island, right? I read some recent articles, you know, a February article and, you know, 2019 and another more recent article about the rebuilding, because this is very common when a place gets destroyed. Lots of countries pledge, and then they don't produce any money.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Russian media tells us little about massive wildfires in Siberia this summer, but the European Eyes on the Earth, the Copernicus Atmosphere Monitoring Service, can see it directly. Smoke from those fires traveled around the world. Dr. Mark Parrington is a senior scientist at the European Center for Medium-Range Weather Forecasts. He works on the Copernicus Project. And they've tracked over 100 big wildfires in the Arctic Circle just since June. Mark, please tell us what satellite images reveal about the 2019 fires in Siberia so far.
Yes, hi, Alex. So in the Copernicus Atmosphere Monitoring Service, we're using satellite observations of active fires. So these aren't specifically like the visible images that you often see in the media. It's measuring like heat signals at the surface. And these heat signals come from fires, of course, but they can also come from other cases, such as volcanoes and gas flaring and things like this. We use that data because it's available in near real time. And it also gives us a means of estimating the heat output from fires. And from that, we can then estimate emissions of different pollutants and aerosols. And we want to do that because we're running atmospheric composition or air quality forecasts, if you like, in much the same way that weather forecasts are produced. And that these fire emissions are a source of pollution, and we want to have those as accurate and timely as possible so that we can then track where the smoke goes. It's also true, however, that there are then visible satellite images, and what they show is then what the status of the surface looks like. So you can see smoke in them, you can see burn scars in them, and you can see how big the fires grow to. It's slightly different information to what we use in CAMS and what we provide in CAMS, but the two of them together are very complementary and give us a very clear picture of what's happening in global fires, and in particular in Siberia and the Arctic Circle over the last couple of months.
Compared to past years, is this an unusual fire season in Siberia?
So using the data that we have, those satellite observations that I just described, in the summer, I would expect that we see some fire detections within the Arctic Circle and especially across Siberia outside of the Arctic Circle during their fire season. But what seems to be the case this year is that there's just been far more of those detections, and they've been quite localized in quite specific regions, particularly within the Arctic Circle. And what's been really unusual is that they've really lasted for such a long period of time. I first noticed these around the second week of June, and they've only really sort of died down and gone back to more average values, if you like, over the last 7 to 10 days or so. So that's nearly 3 months of very high intensity fire activity, which is quite unusual.
In the middle of August, on Twitter, you predicted smoke from Siberian wildfires would cross the Arctic Ocean to reach northern Greenland. Did that happen?
That's right. So in our service, we're producing five-day forecasts of smoke, if you like, particularly when there's significant fire activity. And as well as the fires in the Arctic Circle in Siberia, there's also been quite significant fire activity in central Siberia outside of the Arctic Circle. And during the first couple of weeks of August, there was really significant fire activity in Krasnoyarsk Krai and Irkutsk in central Siberia. And there was a lot of information on Twitter showing that there was this so-called dome of smoke that covered, you know, many thousands of square kilometers over central and eastern Siberia. And in our five-day forecasts of the smoke aerosol, we saw that it was that a plume of this smoke from those fires was predicted to really head up into the high Arctic, cross the North Pole, and reach more or less the north coast of Greenland. And that was persistent in our forecast for a number of days. We haven't been able to fully verify just what the extent of how that smoke transport occurred with independent data yet. One of the challenges with looking at smoke from satellite observations is that if we only use visible imagery, it's sometimes often easy to lose track of the smoke. You don't necessarily see it against the Earth's surface below. But the data that we're using in our system are observations of the aerosol content in the atmosphere. So this isn't just using visible imagery. So we can actually see then where there is aerosol in the atmosphere that we wouldn't necessarily be able to see by eye. But one of the critical steps of the work that we do is that we verify our forecasts against independent measurements from the ground, which generally, anecdotally, generally show that our forecasts are usually quite reliable in predicting these kind of smoke transport events.
You know, I pictured the Arctic wind system generally circling around the pole from west to east. So how did smoke from Siberia manage to get to Greenland over the Arctic Ocean?
This is a good point. In general, the atmospheric circulation is from west to east in the Northern Hemisphere. So you have these very well-defined and very well-known upper-level, the polar jets. So you have the jet stream, which is carrying air from west to east, going around the pole, as you say. However, there are changes, day-to-day changes in the synoptic scale weather patterns. And it's not that unusual for then the weather patterns to change in such a way that air masses can travel in slightly different pathways, including going across the pole or even going sort of counter to the direction of the jet streams. It's not an uncommon event, but it's highly variable, and it's similar to how we see weather patterns changing day to day in the weather forecast on the news or on other media.
Mark, do you think the amount of smoke reaching Greenland would be significant enough to darken the ice there, leading to even more warming?
This is also an important point. I think if we consider the Siberian fires in June, and we think of the near field effects, so those fires were occurring quite close to the Arctic coast in northern Russia, and in that case, there seems to have been some observation that there was some deposition of soot or black carbon to the sea ice with visible imagery. In the case of where the transport is that much longer, i.e. crossing from, you know, from Eurasia all the way across the pole to the European Arctic and North American Arctic in Greenland and Northern Canada, usually what we find is when you have those kind of long-range transport events, that the aerosol is higher in altitude in the atmosphere. And so it's not easy to find where it's interacting then with the ground. We do have data in our system, which we haven't yet had a look at. We haven't yet had time to look at, which gives us an estimate of how much aerosol is deposited at the surface. And I think once we have a look at that data, it will be able to help us work out whether smoke from those fires did actually reach the surface over Greenland. And if that is the case, then there is the possibility of that soot being deposited on the ice sheet and accelerating melting local to that deposition.
What did you see regarding smoke from wildfires in Alaska this past summer?
Okay, well, Alaska also contributed quite significantly to the wildfire emissions in the Arctic Circle around the end of June, beginning of July. And for sure, they did produce huge amounts of smoke. And so we saw a lot of that did seem to hang around locally, around central Alaska and Fairbanks, where there was a lot of air quality measurements were showing very high values. And generally, what seemed to be the case with that smoke is there was a long-range transport event which carried that smoke across Canada as far as the Great Lakes, where I think there was also some reports, I think I remember seeing, of enhanced air quality in those regions related to the transport of smoke from those fires.
So the Copernicus system can measure aerosols, including wildfire smoke, and you've given us a couple of clues, but since it's not directly visible always by satellite, how do you do it?
Okay, well, this is a very complicated process. We have our model of global atmospheric composition, and so this is essentially a weather model, a weather prediction model, the European Centre's weather prediction model. So we know it's a very good weather prediction model. And into that model, we've included all kinds of things related to emissions of aerosols and pollutants and all of it, and different gases, and also the chemistry of the air, of how those gases react with each other and with aerosols. And so modeling is one thing, but then the way we have some accuracy or have some confidence in our forecast is that we initialize each forecast based on satellite observation.
I remember seeing news stories from the big fires in the west of North America last year. The smoke actually reached Europe. Did you hear about that?
Yeah, that's right. I've been monitoring these now for the last few summers in quite close detail. And it's quite a common occurrence each summer that we would see smoke being transported right across the Atlantic to European airspace, where it is also then measured by independent sources. So far this year, there hasn't been too much of that. There was a case at the end of May with the really big fires that were occurring in northern Alberta at that time, where I think we did see one of these long-range transport events, and I think people in Western Europe were reporting the skies having a very red tint to them early one morning, which was coincident with the transport of that smoke across to us. And then there's been other cases in other years as well. I think one of the really famous cases in recent years was a pyroconvective event, which injected aerosol into the stratosphere above British Columbia. And this was smoke that persisted in the lower stratosphere for several months and was detected over Europe for quite some time.
Are scientists really convinced that global warming has led to more wildfires in northern latitudes? And if so, what should we expect in the future?
I think that's a very difficult question to answer. What seems to be the case, at least for the Arctic fires this year, was that in June, where those fires originally started in the Siberian part of the Arctic, is when we looked at the climate monitoring that we do. So at ECMWF, we run CAMS, but we also run the Copernicus Climate Change Service, C3S. And every month they produce a climate bulletin, which looks at anomalies in surface temperature and precipitation, humidity, soil moisture, these kind of things. And in that case, the fires in the Arctic, in Siberia, for sure were occurring in a place where those anomalies were stronger. So there was a strong positive temperature anomaly up to maybe 10 degrees above the climatology, and also very dry conditions. And so it seems very clear this year for the Arctic that fires have been occurring where it's warmer and drier. And this was something that was predicted in the scientific literature a few years ago. And so essentially it's difficult to get a very clear signal between climate change and wildfires, because the wildfires require that, or a mechanism of ignition. And you might have the perfect conditions, but if there isn't an ignition, then you won't get any fire. But when it is warmer and drier through a changing climate, when there is that mechanism for ignition, then fires are able to potentially persist for many weeks, as has been the case of what we've seen across the Arctic Circle in the summer of 2019.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Mark Parrington, senior scientist for the Copernicus Atmosphere Monitoring Service. We're talking about fire and smoke as the Earth heats up. So my next question for you, Mark, maybe it's too early to answer because all the figures aren't in, but do you have a sense of how the fires in the Arctic this summer compared to fires in Amazon or in African Congo and Angola? How significant are these Arctic fires on a global scale?
Well, I think they're significant in themselves just for the location that they are occurring. It's not really possible to compare those fires with those in the Amazon or those in tropical Africa, in much the same way that it's not really possible to compare the fires in the Amazon with the fires in tropical Africa either. I mean, the circumstances are all very different. What's burning is very different, and how the carbon cycle is responding to that is different as well. We can estimate something in terms of the equivalent carbon dioxide that's emitted. And that's, in a way, that's useful for giving some context when we compare against fossil fuel emissions from different countries, for example. But to really compare what's happening in Siberia against the Amazon, against tropical Africa, is not really a possibility.
Are the impacts of northern wildfire smoke limited to the Arctic? For example, could smoke from some of those fires cause breathing problems for some people in northern Europe?
Well, no. So the impact, clearly the impacts on air quality of wildfires is very, very strong and very severe, very close to where the fires are burning. And as we discussed a little bit earlier, though, we do see these so-called long-range transport of pollution events. So this occurs because some of the constituents in smoke, so you think of smoke, it's aerosols, but then there's also a lot of other reactive gases and trace gases in there, and some of those are very unpleasant to breathe and very, very harmful to human health. And some of those constituents can also persist in the atmosphere for several days to weeks and months even. And so what that means is when the smoke is picked up by the winds and transported thousands of kilometers downwind, when that air mass then descends into the boundary layer or descends into closer to the surface in populated areas, then it will exacerbate any local air pollution effect. So there is a possibility that smoke from fires can affect air quality and people's day-to-day health, you know, a long way from the source.
We're often told that smoke, for example, from volcanoes can actually cause cooling by shielding out some of the sun's energy. Does that apply to the northern smoke your team studied this summer, Mark? Can we have heat and yet a sort of cooling effect at the same time?
We can. This is true. It's a very complicated process in how the smoke interacts with radiation in the atmosphere. This is essentially what we're looking at. This is something that I and some colleagues have been studying in the Arctic for a number of years, where when we see smoke transport events into the high Arctic, we can then look at what that means in terms of the solar radiation that can get to the surface. So as you say, this cooling mechanism would be that you have a cloud of smoke and it reflects solar radiation back to space. So, and that would ultimately lead to a cooling at the surface. And we do see that. We see a signal in the radiation change when that smoke is there of a cooling of some degree at the surface local to where the smoke plume is. However, it is much more complicated because there are indirect effects of aerosol on radiation, which can actually lead to a heating as well. So depending on what constituents there are in the smoke, it doesn't necessarily mean that there will always be a net cooling effect in this case. It's a very difficult thing to estimate. We do have the data to estimate it, and it is an active area of research. It's not something we can very quickly give answers to as the events are occurring.
You know, these days a lot of my information comes from all kinds of people on Twitter, and it's my experience that social media is sometimes far ahead of what scientists tell us. In addition to the tools like satellites that you've talked about, are climate experts also crunching social media to see what people on the ground are reporting?
This isn't something that we do in our service, and it's not something that we're able to do, but I am aware that I think there are some researchers out there which are looking into how social media reports for events related to, say, wildfires or volcanoes or air pollution in general, if that data can be mined to then, you know, provide extra information for forecasts and that. But currently, this isn't something that we incorporate in our service.
Why does the European Union fund the kind of global research your unit makes available to every government and even to the public?
Well, the idea is that with the Copernicus program is to be able to provide free and open access data to everybody, partly as a means of developing applications and for broadening the knowledge of environmental issues to everybody. It's not, in this day and age, it's not enough for an organization to say, well, we know that there's smoke here or there's this fire there. Really, the data needs to be free and open access so that you're not just taking our word for it. You can actually go and get your hands on that data and see for yourself.
What is the European Center for Medium Range Weather Forecast? Who funds it and what does it do?
So here at the European Center for Medium Range Weather Forecast, we're an intergovernmental organization in Europe. We're a research institute and a 24/7 operational service. And what that means is we produce global weather predictions and other data for our member and cooperating states. So we're an international organization, and we're funded by different European governments that make up our member states.
Can you give us any tips on how our listeners can use data from Copernicus?
Well, sure. I mean, so one of the ways Copernicus works is, on the one hand, is to provide satellite data, and there is, you know, different online tools for then looking at different satellite data provided by Copernicus. But what we have in CAMS and also with the climate change service that I mentioned is these are data services which take Earth observation data from satellites and put it, you know, with a particular application. So in our case, it's atmospheric composition. And the idea being that it makes that data a bit more understandable, a bit more usable for users. So rather than, you know, so you're sitting at home listening to this and you think, oh, I want to know more about aerosol from satellites. You can take the satellite data, but sometimes that's quite tricky to use because it's quite a specialized data set. There's lots of gaps in it, and interpreting it can be quite tricky. But what we do is by assimilating that into our model, we get then a much smoother field, and it's something that is maybe a bit easier to interpret when you look at it. In the first instance, what I would recommend is there's a number of mobile phone apps out there which are taking our data to then get that data more directly to users. And on our website, which is atmosphere.copernicus.eu, there are various links to some of those applications.
And as we wrap up here, what are the key things we still need to know in your field, and what are you working on next?
I think the key thing for us in CAMS is how we best manage with this huge wealth of data that we have available from satellites. We're currently using data from a fleet of satellites, some of which have been going for a very long time. I think 20 years is probably the longest one now. And on the horizon, we already have in our sites a number of other satellite missions for monitoring atmospheric composition, which we will also make use of in our service. Perhaps the next big thing on the horizon, though, is the use of geostationary satellites for atmospheric composition and air quality. So currently, the satellites we use, they go around in orbits and they pass the equator at more or less the same local solar time each overpass. But what that means is then you get maybe one or two overpasses per day for where you're located. With the geostationary, it sits in the same position, and it will then observe at a much higher time frequency. So with the other satellites, we get very good observations once a day or so, but with the geostationary, we'll get observations over a much wider area with much higher frequency. So we'll really then be able to see how fires or atmospheric pollution is changing on a much higher time resolution.
From Europe, we have been speaking with Dr. Mark Parrington, Senior Scientist for Copernicus Atmosphere Monitoring Service. To learn more, you can find links in my weekly show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Mark, thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
Coming up next, Paul Beckwith has more tales to tell about death and survival in the Caribbean. This is Radio EcoShock. My guest is Canadian climate scientist Paul Beckwith. We are talking about storms of right now. And the power of this storm, Dorian, reminded me of a paper by James Hansen and Paul Harty. As part of their 121-page synthesis paper, they calculated that around 100,000 years ago, monster storms greater than we have ever seen smashed into the Caribbean. And that was in their paper, Ice Melt, Sea Level Rise, and Superstorms. And I think you did about 9 videos on that paper, didn't you?
Yes, I did. That was a few years ago.
Well, according to Hansen and Harty, the storm surge left massive rocks bigger than houses high in the hills of some islands, including the Bahamian island of Eleuthera, and they cited higher seas and violent storms as the cause. And then I recently found that a second study from the University of Bremen and the Leibniz Center said those rocks could have been tossed that high just with today's storms when sea levels were 20 to 30 feet higher during the Eemian hot period. That was around 125,000 years ago. I guess where I'm going with this, as sea levels rise and the oceans get hotter and hotter, could we see even bigger hurricanes that threaten to batter the Caribbean and the United States, forcing a retreat from the sea?
Yes, that's a big risk, of course. And it leads to the question, direct question today, should we rebuild at all? This is what humans do, right? Stuff gets destroyed and people just rebuild and rebuild and rebuild. But we have to really think differently and start getting a lot smarter about this. I mean, in previous shows and, we both talked about areas of the world that could become uninhabitable. And we've talked about places in the Middle East, for example, next to bodies of water, where if the water temperature gets to 35 Celsius, then the wet bulb temperature, you'll have 100% humidity on the coastlines with that temperature over 35. And people can't live outside for more than a day. They get heat exhaustion, heat stroke, and their body shuts down. They're outside, so they have to be confined to inside. So those areas, are candidates for becoming uninhabitable. But also the Caribbean islands are in the direct firing line of these hurricanes. And, with rapid sea level rise and the latest science in the last decade on how we're getting more and more category 4s and 5s and less 1s and 2s, like I said, 35 to 40% more category 4s and 5s than that decrease in 1s and 2s. The ocean temperature is so much warmer, and the hot water fuels these storms. Anything over 26.5 degrees Celsius amplifies the storms. The jet streams are slowing and wavier, so the steering of the storms is, the storms are slowing down and even stalling. I mean, I've never seen the National Hurricane Center forecast, on Dorian was stationary, storm stationary, right? And then it's moving 1 mile an hour and so on. I mean, these things are all, that's the reality of today, and they're getting worse. So one thing that I really suggested quite a bit is that, like they knew the storm was coming, right? They knew Dorian was coming, and it was, Bahamas, the Northern Islands were in the bullseye, but they had no capability or capacity to get people off the island in any large numbers. I mean, maybe 1,000, 2,000 left in private boats or things like that. I don't know. So what I think would be very important to give these Caribbean islands some resilience is they need to buy and run their own cruise boats, right? Because if they own the cruise boats, they could run the cruise boats with their own people. There's high unemployment on these islands, and 50% of their revenue is from tourism anyway. So they run the cruise boats, and then you can collect the huge profits from the cruise boats and use them into making your islands more resilient. But if they own their own cruise boats, and they can carry 5,000 people plus for a week at a time with all the food and everything. If they were just using it to transport people from one island to another, they could probably get 10 or 15,000 or more on one cruise boat. So they could have sent a couple of boats to the island and got everybody off, you know, the day before the storm struck, for example. So I think if they actually managed and owned their own cruise boats, that would be a way that would give these islands much, much greater resiliency.
When I saw you suggest the Bahamas should buy its own cruise ship for evacuations and run them for profit during better weather, my first reaction was, that's just too silly. I couldn't accept that. And then the very next night, ABC News said the government was considering buying at least one cruise ship to house evacuees. So, again, you were right on ahead of everybody else, and it may very well happen.
Yeah, there's not enough people that do logical thinking. I mean, of course, the large companies on the mainland run the industry, right? And they hire people from all around the world to staff the huge boats. And it's very, you know, it's very wealthy people that go on these long cruises. And because they rely on tourism so much in these small Caribbean islands, it should be all of the Caribbean islands should be running their industry because most of those boats go there. There's a great book called Seasteading by a guy called Joe Quirk, and I bought it sort of on a lark, thinking people should live at sea, basically, is the premise. And, you know, there's an example. There are some people that live at sea. I mean, there's a few elderly people that live on cruise boats, and they basically don't have homes, and they just go around the world wherever the cruise boat takes them. You know, get good medical care. There's a gym right there. They get to see the world. It's not boring, right? And, you know, I mean, they can afford to do it because they don't have a house. They sold their house and they, you know, put the money in, and they're, you know, they basically get good rates to live on the cruise boat, right? So great food and, you know, lots of pluses. So imagine, you know, imagine if they rebuilt these islands but didn't load them up with people, that they had boats offshore, you know, whether it be a cruise type boat or a specially designed boat offshore, and these were anchored to the islands, and you grew your food and got your fresh water and stuff on the islands. The islands were mostly for tourism, and a hurricane comes along, you just sail away and then let the hurricane pass and then come back, and with all the people that are living on these large seasteading type boats, and sea level rises, you know, no big deal for your accommodations, right? I mean, we got to start thinking differently. Like, we can't just go and do everything the way we've used to do it. And, you know, when you think about all of the advantages that these islands would have if they had the capability to move people from island to island by owning their own cruise boats and running them for tourism, but come storm season, you have, I figure, 2 or 3 cruise boats could have got the 50,000 people off the island a day before the Category 5 hit.
Okay, so we're starting to run out of time, Paul. There's like 3 quick things I'd sort of like to just get your take on. One is, I think we need a map of the Caribbean islands that are low enough they will become drowned countries, like Pacific Island countries of Tuvalu or Kiribati. And so far, I haven't found a map showing those low elevation places or a report on the future of the Caribbean in a new climate. Have you found that?
Nothing general on comparing elevations or topography of the region, but if you focus your research on one specific island, for example, you know, if you Google, you can find the information. Like if the topographic map for Grand Bahama, for example, is right on. If you just go to Wikipedia Grand Bahama, right, there's a write up and, you know, about the place and the people, and there's a topographic map. And the same thing with, you go Wikipedia Abaco Island. Right, Great Abaco. You can find the topographic map and the population numbers, you know, recent and you know, all this information. So you could go and do that. You'd have to do that for each of the different islands.
But no, it doesn't seem like anybody's drawn that together. And I think after this storm, that's something that's going to happen. I predict that within the next year, we'll be talking about a scientific paper that looks at the future of the Caribbean in terms of sea level rise and major storms. And the other thing is, where are the people going to go? I mean, the people in the South Pacific Islands, some of them have made arrangements for new land settlements in Australia or New Zealand, and they'll go when they have to. But nobody's talking about that for the Caribbean. And I noticed that America just officially shut its doors to a lot of evacuees from the Bahamas. That's not a way to treat your next door neighbors in an emergency, but that's what's happening. So we don't really have a plan for where people can go.
I know this is a huge problem. I mean, so, you know, the Caribbean, lots of the parts of the Caribbean are at risk of becoming uninhabitable places. And also, island people are generally more resilient than, you know, lots of people that are on large countries on mainland, because they have to be more resilient, right? They're on an island. They can't access things as easily, especially on the smaller islands. So they have to really look at ways they can become more self-reliant. And, you know, again, it comes back to they need the ability to transport large numbers of people from one island to another island, especially, you know, when in hurricane season. You know, if they'd had a couple of cruise boats that hold 5,000 people for a week or 7,000 people for a week, I'm sure you could get 20,000 on one to just shuffle them to another island. So a couple of them, you could have evacuated. They could have evacuated those islands, you know, the day before. And when we knew the storm was coming very accurately, it was going to have a direct hit on these islands. And yet very few people were able to get off those islands. You know what I'm like saying? Like, people just don't grasp the enormity of what's going on.
Yep.
Whenever something like this happens, the deaths reported by the media, it's always, you know, people that have been actually picked up and put in body bags, and then it goes into an official count. You know, when you have a case where most people have been washed out to sea and stuff, I mean, you'll never get a number. You know, and if you don't capture the enormity of the impact on people's lives, then, they'll rebuild the island and it'll just continue as normal, right? But the reality is easy to find out in most of these cases, but people don't have the time to do it themselves. Like, they should say, okay, I mean, I can see them saying five people, you know, like, to say the death toll is at least five is completely negligent reporting. Right? Five people. And they stuck with that for days and days. And I thought, I wonder when they're going to, and that was, in, and then they showed, but they showed all these images of complete destruction on the island. And then the next thing they said, well, the five people were killed.
What this is, Paul, this is public insanity. It's not personal. It's not hidden. It's just public insanity.
Yeah, it is. It is. And this is done all of the time, right? Like, an earthquake destroys a city. You know, you find 10 bodies on the outside, and, you know, there's at least 10 people killed.
Yeah, well, you know, it's like saying, hey, Billy, I know your mom is gone, but she's gone to a better place, and I know she's happy where she is. And so it's like fairy tales that you tell to children.
It is. It really is fairy tales, and they get away with it, right?
Yep.
Like there's not pushback, and like they could say, okay, we've recovered five bodies, but the whole city's gone. It looks like, you know, it's probably thousands and thousands of people, you know. Or they could say that this city has, you know, this island of Abaco Island has 17,000 people documented. You know, we think that there's about 7,000 to 9,000 undocumented Haitians on the island. The island was completely covered with water, and you know, we know of, you know, a few thousand getting off the island. So, you know, the death toll could be staggeringly high, like 10,000, 12,000, 15,000 people on the island. But here we put five people in body bags, right? We've only identified five people, right? Like they just don't have any, they're completely out of touch with reality. And then they spread this around the world, and somebody reads about this big hurricane, and, oh, there's five casualties.
We're all totally out of touch with what is really happening in the world, and I think that's one of the stories of climate change. We can't believe it. We don't want to make any changes. I mean, after a lot of these things happen, Look, after Great Britain declared a climate emergency and various countries declared climate emergencies, I thought, well, good. Now all my neighbors have stopped driving pointlessly and they've canceled their winter vacations to nowhere. But no, they haven't.
Yeah, no. I mean, that's just like empty words, the declaration of climate emergency, yeah. Right? the Canadian government did it. They debated it in Parliament. Didn't they declare it too?
Yes, I think so.
Many cities have, and Ireland has. There's other countries that have. So it's a crazy, crazy situation. But we keep going. We keep ticking, right?
Apparently.
Yeah. I mean, part of what you do actually, helps you deal emotionally with what's going on, right? Because you're doing your bit.
Oh, totally. I would go insane if I couldn't talk about what I see as possible reality with scientists, with people like yourself. Paul, for the opening of this season, I had some important science to cover, but then we had the heat waves in Europe and India, the fires in the Amazon and the Arctic, then this unexpected destruction of the beautiful Bahamas. I feel like you and I are becoming ambulance chasers for climate disasters, this story in wrecking the Bahamas, it made me kind of angry and sad. I just had to walk away for a couple of days, but here we are. Does this drumbeat of climate disasters we all saw coming, does it ever get to you, Paul?
Oh, all the time, yeah. Yeah, it does. Yeah, I mean, it's very, very difficult to deal with it. And, the disruption of the jet streams and the, increase of extreme weather events around the world and the sea ice collapsing, although it was very interesting. I'll do some videos very soon about why the extent stalled, but the volumes tied for a record low, the volume of sea ice, so it's just the way the dynamics of the ice was working. It wasn't like the melt slowed down or anything. But yeah, I mean, there's just very, very difficult to deal with. And, it's quite possible that as things get worse and worse, around the planet, that there's fewer and fewer people that actually talk about what's happening. They want to maintain their sanity. They don't want to, go off and get completely stressed and anxiety and so on and not be able to function. Right. So, it's far easier for the human psyche just to, turn this stuff off. Right. Even for people that, study it deeply.
Well, I'm asking people to turn it on with your YouTube videos at paulbeckwith.net and with my radio show at ecoshock.org. We have to wrap it up there. From Ottawa, we have been talking with Canadian climate scientist Paul Beckwith. And be sure and support his work at his website, paulbeckwith.net. Thank you again, Paul, and let's stay in touch as always.
Thanks a lot, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Let me add one personal story, and it is something that makes me less suitable to host this show. When I was 15, I took a bus to Florida around spring break. With little money, I was looking for a way to get a dirt cheap hotel room and some food. It was actually cheaper to take a cruise ship to the Bahamas, at their bottom rate, than to stay in Fort Lauderdale, so I went. Since I had no jacket and tie for the dining room, ship management sent me to the back table, and that was where all the Bahamian staff ate. We became great friends. Landing at Nassau, a half dozen Bahamians loaded me in an old car heading into the back hills, and there I learned that white people are so uptight they barely know how to laugh and don't think it's right to laugh in public. We danced all night, me a skinny teen, great music, the only white person around. The Bahamians were so deeply friendly, so kind to me, so able to laugh and enjoy life. Now, these thousands dead in the Bahamas, killed by a climate-enhanced Hurricane Dorian, they are real to me. I mourn the people and the life lost there. I touched this story and got hurt. I dedicate this program to the good people of the Bahamas. I will be back next week, and I hope you will be too. This is Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.